This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Bernanke headache number 2008. Some days the Fed chairman must feel like he's being pushed and pulled in two opposing directions. This was definitely one of those days. And there's no easy relief. Lower interest rates and you risk higher inflation. But the alternative might just be a long recession. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. Conversations from the Corner Office, Dialogues with Top CEOs, is supported by Society for Human Resource Management, online at shrm.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl. Appreciate you being with us on this Tuesday, the 15th day of 2008, a day of bad flashbacks from the 1970s for a group you don't normally associate with bad flashbacks, economists. No, it wasn't pet rocks or disco music that set them off. It was two scary sets of numbers. First, wholesale inflation for 2007. Those are the prices at the farm and factory gates, shot up by the largest amount in 26 years. Second, retail sales fell in December, closing out the weakest year at the cash register since 2002. Put it together, high inflation plus a slowing economy, and it could equal stagflation. Marketplace's Jill Barshay looks into whether that scourge of the 70s might be coming back.
When the economy wobbles, it's usually inflation or recession doing the shaking. Inflation usually hits when the economy is booming. High demand for goods pushes prices up. When recession bites, the opposite happens. Demand drops off and companies lower prices to move product out the door. But when high prices and a recession coincide, that's stagflation.
More and more people are starting to say, well, do we have a stagflation problem? We're certainly closer than we've been in a long time.
Peter Kretzmer is a senior economist at Bank of America. He says prices are being driven higher by the rising cost of oil. But at the same time, the economy is slowing and more people are losing their jobs.
What could be more important? Do I have a job? And what's the cost of the goods and services I'm buying? If both of those things are going in the wrong direction, obviously that's a problem for consumers. And
it's an even bigger problem for policymakers. Central bankers haven't got much in the way of weaponry. They can adjust interest rates or pump money into the economy. Richard Silla is an economic and financial historian at New York University. He says the Fed is caught between a rock and a hard place.
If it prints a lot of money to keep the economy from sinking into recession, then all that money is likely to put upward pressure on prices. And if the Fed decides that it's worried more about inflation than economic weakness, well, then it doesn't create so much more money, and the economy then slips into recession.
Both Silla and Kretzmer say the Fed is making the recession enemy number one. There's talk about the Fed cutting interest rates by a half point this month. But when the economic slowdown is over, they say, we'll likely be paying more for everything. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
Given that the high cost of gasoline figured very prominently into those inflation numbers today, and especially with pump prices already hovering around $3 a gallon, this might not have been the most opportune moment to suggest the federal gas tax needs to go up. But somebody's got to foot the bill to fix our aging bridges and roads, and the tab could be up to 40 cents a gallon. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
The gas tax hasn't gone up since 1993, and with the economy on the skids, some argue that now's not the time to raise it. Matt Gardner's with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy.
Without a doubt, we know that low and middle income people are going to get hit hardest by this.
That's because a gas tax takes a larger percentage of a low income family's salary than it does from the rich. But a bipartisan commission set up by Congress says we need the money to fix aging infrastructure. Tom Skanke is one of the 12 commission members.
A lot of us have known for a number of years that the system that we have that is deteriorating. We have not made the investments that we need to maintain our system.
Skanke and the majority on the commission are calling for a gas tax hike of about 5 to 8 cents per gallon over 5 years. They also want to boost surface transportation investment to $225 billion annually for 50 years. But three of the panel members dissented. Cornell University professor Rick Geddes was one of them. He says the gas tax increase goes against Bush administration energy policy.
We're trying to increase fuel efficiency, discourage gas consumption, and to try to increase the reliance on the gas tax as a revenue source is in conflict with the energy policy of trying to reduce the consumption of that good which is taxed.
The House holds a hearing on the report later this week, and a Senate committee will review it next week. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Wall Street had a whole bunch of negative news to chew over today, from those growing stagflation fears to a $10 billion loss for Citigroup, the biggest in the bank's 196-year history. Citigroup will cut 4,200 jobs, slash its dividend, and get a much-needed cash infusion from outside investors. We'll check out the fallout when we do the numbers. Apple's got a new line of widgets for 2008. These announcements are breathlessly awaited every year at this time during the Mac World Expo in San Francisco. So what did Steve Jobs unveil today? A super thin laptop turned out to be the hot new product, which raises the question, so what?
How can you compete with something as big and as exciting as the iPhone? And the short answer is you really can't.
Dan Ackerman reviews computers for CNET.
Nothing here is as big as the iPhone, but you do have a pretty solid line of stuff.
There's the new laptop, dubbed the MacBook Air. Jobs pulled it out of a manila envelope. There's also a revamped version of Apple TV that will allow online movie rental and purchase. We caught up with Business Week editor Eric Heseldahl on his cell phone at the big event. He says Apple is focusing on a whole new marketplace.
It's not a computer company anymore. It's almost an entertainment company. I mean, it's got shades of, you know, replacing the old Blockbuster in your neighborhood. You know, it's part of your telecommunications life.
Heseldahl has covered tech for 12 years and says the entertainment industry is ripe for a player like Apple.
Apple's got more than $15 billion in cash. It has an awful lot of cultural currency. So if they wanted to do this, they certainly could.
And here's the Associated Press take on today's announcements. It says they burnish Apple's polished image as a purveyor of cool. Then again, investors apparently didn't think it was all that hot. Apple shares fell almost $10, or nearly 5.5% today. And now news from a different part of the computer world. Everyone knows politicians play games, but gamers playing politics? The video game industry is worth $14 billion a year, and it's looking for some clout. As Marketplace's Lisa Napoli explains, there's a new game of Pac-Man in Washington.
A struggle has raged throughout history between those who fight to preserve liberty and those who intrude upon it.
While someone you love has been staring into a screen, joystick in hand, the video game industry has been mobilizing players with an online campaign.
But now is the time to fight back. Answer the call and defend our video games.
Now, the industry group known as the Entertainment Software Association is launching its own political action committee. It's the group's latest effort to make its presence known among lawmakers.
The PAC is a symbol of maturity of the video game industry.
That's Michael Gallagher, who heads up the association.
It's a very easy way for our industry to show its support for elected officials who share our values.
Meaning, says Gallagher, elected officials who don't want to regulate the sale of games. Hal Halpin of the Entertainment Consumers Association says there are 100 pieces of legislation introduced each year that would affect the industry.
They usually seek to restrict violence or sex in games and treat it differently than music or movies or television.
Halpin says many politicians have misperceptions about the gaming industry because they haven't grown up with it and don't play. Even as gamers start to get themselves elected, having a political presence behind the massive industry can't hurt. In Los Angeles, I'm Lisa Napoli for Marketplace.
Give this next story to a Hollywood writer, and it might come out sounding something like this. In a world where time stands still, the pressure is on, now more than ever. That's because some of the major studios seem to be sending their strongest signal yet. The current TV season is now beyond rescue. They've started canceling big-money contracts with writers for the development and production of new shows. And since this is the time of year when those writers usually start work on new pilots for the next season, even those shows could be threatened. Joe Adalian is TV editor for Variety. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Run down the casualty list, if you will. How serious is this for the writers and for their prospective new shows?
Well, what's happened in the last 72 hours or so has been that the major TV studios have canceled a number of their overall deals with writers. These are development deals for writers and some producers to develop new projects. Started on Friday when ABC Studios canceled about 25 deals, and on Monday, about 50 more deals from all the other studios followed suit. Someone said to me it was a Black Friday and an even blacker Monday. And what this reflects is the fact that basically development season is sort of over as we know it for this year. A lot of studios and networks are now saying that even if the strike is settled in the next week or two, they're not going to develop 10, 15, 20 pilots and then choose which ones to bring up to series. They're just going to pick and choose a few new shows and bring back all the old shows from this season and try again. And it's going to mean a loss of millions and millions of dollars for writers in the community.
And does this affect next season as well?
It could. It means that most likely, come fall, you'll see fewer new shows. Instead of 35 or 40 new fall shows, you may only see 15 or 20. And that's assuming that the strike settles in the next few months. If the strike goes on until May or June, then who knows what happens. But there's so much uncertainty right now. You know, the good news is that there's a lot of evidence that the Directors Guild is close to making a deal with the studios.
So the strike's gone on for a couple of months now. Is there any sign of progress, or is it really all up to the directors?
Right now, it's up to the directors. I mean, there have been little formal contact in about 6 weeks between the two sides. There doesn't appear to be any back-channel conversations going on. I think what everyone's waiting to see is, can the directors make a deal? That seems likely. And once we see the deal, what are the specifics? What are the terms of the deal? If there is legitimate progress on new media issues, which are really at the heart of the strike, then the writers will sort of be under intense pressure to accept the deal or to try to get back to the bargaining table. I predict that if there is a deal, the studios, it would be in their best interest to make an overture to say, we're going to get back to the bargaining table using this as a basis. Sit down and talk to us with this deal as the starting point.
Well, you mentioned good news, but we also keep hearing bad news here. Word that the musicians don't want to cross the picket lines for the Grammys.
Well, it's some musicians wouldn't, and many actors, SAG members who also happen to be musicians, you know, they may not want to cross either. And that's a real question. I mean, so far the Guild has had a just conquer and destroy strategy when it comes to most award shows. They got rid of the Globes. They got rid of the People's Choice. They're targeting potentially the Oscars, and the Grammys would sort of be another one. It's going to be tough to bring down the Grammys, but certainly if the Writers Guild really went after it, it could disrupt it.
Settlement or not, this is a big mess, isn't it? The advertisers don't know what shows they're going to be sponsoring. We don't even know what the shows are going to be.
It is a big mess to some degree, you know, but not as big a mess as maybe the writers would hope, only because, you know, the networks now are a lot more diversified. They're owned by major corporations that can absorb losses. And they also, the rise of reality TV shows has made it a lot easier for networks to survive strikes. You know, NBC, which was the fourth place network in the fall with scripted shows, has put on a lot of reality shows in recent weeks and suddenly is challenging for second place. So the networks haven't really felt the pain yet. They're starting to, and the longer the strike goes on, there's no doubt about it, they will feel the pain. The question is, are the writers willing to tough it out? That's why the studios canceled all these overall deals. They want to bring the pain to the writers as soon as possible and try to divide that membership. It's open war between both sides.
Well, we can keep hoping they write a happy ending, huh?
Give peace a chance.
Joe Adalian is TV editor for Variety. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Coming up, small businesses in a small African country lobby for locals only.
If no steps are being taken, in no time, the whole economy will be in the hands of the Chinese.
But first, let's do the numbers. Fear returned to Wall Street today. A looming recession, lower retail sales, and more subprime problems sparked a whopping sell-off. The Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 277 points, or 2.1%, to close at 12,501. The Nasdaq lost 60 points, or 2.4%, to finish at 2417. The S&P 500 nosedived 35 points, or 2.4%, to 1380. We talked about Citigroup's bad news earlier. The bank's shares fell more than 7% and pulled much of the financial sector with it. J.P. Morgan gave up more than 5%. Williams-Sonoma was skewered by some weak sales over the holiday. The high-end housewares maker fell nearly 10%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing thousands of reports on local service companies. These reports come directly from the experiences of the members themselves. Angie'sList.com. Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Calvert.com. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday, January 16th. In Washington, the Labor Department releases the Consumer Price Index for December. President Bush meets with Egyptian President Mubarak, wrapping up his Mideast trip. And on Capitol Hill, the Joint Economic Committee talks about ways to avoid a possible recession. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. After 7 years, there's a formal decision on the safety of food from cloned animals. The verdict? It's safe, at least according to the Food and Drug Administration. Now, we're talking about cloned cows, pigs, and goats, just to be clear. The FDA says sheep are another story and need a closer look. Today's decision comes despite protests from consumer groups and Congress, which passed a bill urging further study. And a Sarah Gardner report, some of the country's biggest food companies don't have much appetite for the technology either.
According to the FDA, meat and milk from clones and their offspring are as safe to eat as food from conventionally bred animals. That's good news for a handful of small companies that are pushing the technology. Outfits like Viagen in Austin, Texas, charge about $13,500 to replicate a prize cow, for example. But some of the biggest names in the U.S. food industry, Tyson, Dean Foods, and Smithfield, among others, say they have no plans to buy food from cloned livestock, at least for now. Tyson's Gary Michelson.
Whatever measures we ultimately take will be guided by government regulations and the desires of our customers and consumers.
Key word there, consumers. Americans are relatively nonchalant about genetically modified grains and veggies, but many are starting to reject certain farm practices like injecting growth hormones into dairy cows. Cloning is even more suspect to many consumers, says Will Rostoff, an attorney with the Center for Food Safety.
Well, I think there's a big problem here because one of the things that FDA has done is they're not requiring labeling. So people aren't going to know if their meat or milk is from cloned animals. it's going to create a huge public relations problem for a food industry whose customers don't want these products.
But Mark Walton, the CEO of Viagen, says consumers just don't understand the technology. He says much of what people know of clones is from sci-fi movies, and the clone is always a scary bad guy. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Millions of Americans take a drug called Vytorin, which is made with another medication called Zetia. As sales go, it's been a multi-billion dollar blockbuster. Trouble is, it hasn't exactly been a cholesterol buster. Merck and Schering Plough are now acknowledging the drug doesn't prevent heart attacks. In fact, it may actually speed up clogging of the coronary arteries. Commentator and physician Dr. Stefan Kertész says it's a cautionary tale about the whole process of approving new pharmaceuticals.
This week's news that Vytorin and its sister drug Zetia don't seem to help patients and might be harmful is not just about the toxicity of yet another drug. It's about the toxic interplay of the pharmaceutical industry and the experts who write the guidelines and set the benchmarks doctors aspire to. To see how this works, let's look back to 2004. On July 12th of that year, the Federal National Cholesterol Education Panel made an announcement. For patients with heart disease or diabetes, doctors should consider an especially low goal for bad cholesterol of 70. Not all experts agreed. A lot of us thought it would be costly and risky to do whatever it takes just to get the cholesterol down. But doctors across the country gulped, reached for their prescription pads, and then realized that a lot of patients couldn't reach the new target without a new drug. Then, 11 days later, Merck and Schering Plough introduced Vytorin. One inconvenient fact emerged soon thereafter. Of the cholesterol guidelines' 9 authors, 8 disclosed significant financial ties to the pharmaceutical industry, 7 specifically to Merck and Schering Plough. I'm not suggesting that these experts have opinions for sale. The problem is that when data are conflicting, wishful thinking and commercial interests may supplant a rational consideration of the facts. To protect patients, we need to do 2 things. We should demand entirely public disclosure of the financial ties for any expert who helps define the standards for quality in healthcare. And we should demand that at least some of our experts come from outside the industry altogether. The point is this. The science of drug development and the science of quality in healthcare represent 2 very different enterprises. If we continue to let the drug developers have such a strong hand in defining quality, we will continue to fall prey to conjecture, to wishful thinking, and hype. It would be best for our health to keep these 2 enterprises separate.
Dr. Stefan Kertész is on the faculty at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. He asks that we disclose to you that he serves on the board of a charity that receives funding from Merck. Your thoughts? Visit us at marketplace.org and click on Contact. China's foreign minister is in Africa this week to discuss trade and economic deals. Africa's copper, iron ore, and oil are helping feed China's economic growth. In fact, last year, trade between China and African countries jumped more than 30%. It works both ways. A growing class of Chinese entrepreneurs are running small businesses in Africa, including Lesotho, one of the poorest countries in the world. And as Gretchen Wilson reports, that area has become a flashpoint for new tensions between local Africans and Chinese business people.
Motsekoa is a town with a dusty main street and epic mountain views. It's like the Old West. The Trading Post is a general store run by a family of Chinese immigrants. Chinese make up less than 1% of Lesotho's population of 2 million. But in even the tiniest town here, you'll find a store run by China's aspiring business class. These family-owned businesses are known as China shops, and they offer everything from cornmeal and cooking oil to dish towels and padlocks, all at rock-bottom prices. But the economic success of these Chinese traders has a dangerous effect.
They are killing Basotho businesses all over. Up in the mountains, you find Chinese. They're all over. They're killing us, I'm telling you.
In the capital, Maseru, 59-year-old Matabo Mabekla sells wood carvings and jewelry on the sidewalk. For 14 years, she owned the city's most successful ladies' clothing boutique. But she says she closed down last year because she couldn't compete with Chinese retailers.
Chinese are selling very cheap and not quality things. So they go for those cheap things because the economy in this country is dying.
Mabekla is one of many informal traders who blame the Chinese for driving them out of business. In November, traders in the capital went on a rampage, throwing stones at Chinese grocery stores, clothing shops, and internet cafes. Riot police restored calm, but tensions remain.
The Chinese, they must go back home, back to China. We don't want Chinese here.
Some opposition politicians and radio stations play up this anti-Chinese sentiment, making them easy targets.
This is certainly a potential flashpoint.
Martin Davis is director of the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University. He says that as China increases its presence across Africa, hostilities flare up when stoked for political ends.
This is certainly a risk, I think, for Chinese business and Chinese people in Africa, and one which needs to be very carefully managed by African governments and also perhaps through intervention or involvement by the Chinese government themselves.
Government meddling hasn't happened yet in Lesotho. In fact, relations between governments are swell. Lesotho offers tax incentives to bring Chinese apparel factories here. They've become the country's largest employers. And China's floated the country with $36 million in grants and loans. Mabaetsi Matsumai is Lesotho's director of industry.
We do need investment, and we do encourage foreign direct investment. If we didn't, probably wouldn't have any investment if we were just saying only local.
But Chinese retailers have the built-in advantage. With their links to China, they're plugged into the global economy in the way the Basutu aren't. That puts Lesotho in a bind, one faced by developing countries around the world. How do you draw foreign investment without driving your own citizens out of business? Lesotho's business leaders say the government should train local entrepreneurs to compete as the global economy comes to their doorstep. Tabam Mukatse is with the Lesotho Chamber of Commerce.
If no steps are being taken, in no time, the whole economy will be in the hands of the Chinese.
But Chinese business owners say the formula for success is simple.
We are Chinese, we can very hard.
Chen Keihui is chairman of the Chinese Business Association of Lesotho. Key to his success has been his ability to integrate here. He speaks Sotho better than English, has a Sotho name, Tabiso, and is an honored guest at his employees' weddings and funerals. He says he personally doesn't feel any resentment from local people.
You know, African people, it's nice people. We are here together.
In fact, Chen and his family have traded in their Chinese passports to become naturalized citizens of Lesotho. But in this frontier of globalization, some of their new compatriots see them as competitors. In Maseru, Lesotho, I'm Gretchen Wilson for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
And this final note, Oprah. Perhaps you've heard of her. She's got a top-rated talk show, a magazine, her own satellite radio channel, and now she's starting a television network. The matriarch of daytime programming will add her backing to the Oprah Winfrey Network. Since this is radio, we'll spell that out for you. That's O-W-N, the OWN channel. Discovery Communications, known for TLC and Animal Planet, is going 50-50 on the venture. This is Winfrey's second try for a channel. She was a major and early backer of Oxygen. That's a network for women, now known for quality programs like The Bad Girls Club and Husband for Hire. Oprah says Oxygen did not reflect her voice. Lucky for her, she now has a channel of her own. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 277 points, 2%. The Nasdaq lost 60 points, 2%. And the S&P 500 fell 35 points, 2% again. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Next time on the program, big guys bearing a big burden, fashion.
After a while, you get to the point where you just don't want to go shopping. You'd literally go in going, okay, this will fit, this will fit. I don't care.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.